speaker on this panel is Simon Salmon. And my question to you is MA in communication studies that will be really interesting. Your research paper examines the cultural politics of identity within organized battle rap leagues, with specific focus on Canadian and American leagues. And the title of this paper that he's going to today is Is It Really Real? Canadian Hip Hop Struggle for Authentic Identity.
All right, so my current research is geared towards the performance and construction of identity that takes place through organized battle rap leagues. And the paper that I'm presenting today is really foundational for that work and pertains to something that is very dear to my heart, which is Canadian hip hop. So with this research, I was hoping to probe the ways in which Canadian rappers, specifically those rappers who do not fit the typical rap mold that is portrayed in the mainstream media, negotiate their identities as outsiders in a field of cultural production that organizes itself around being real and authentic. And the basic argument that I put forth is that the cultural politics intertwined with issues of race, place, and commerce that lie beneath the surface of rap and hip-hop culture are far more complex and paradoxical than one would immediately assume, which complicates the quest for identity faced by Canadian rap musicians. So what led me to explore this topic in the first place was actually my own role in the Canadian hip-hop scene. Before I decided to take academic endeavors more seriously, rapping was my main area of interest. And I actually got into it very young. I was about 12 years old. And even at that young age, I wanted to be a DJ, since I had it in my head that a white guy from a decent financial background couldn't possibly be a rapper. But eventually I started rapping anyway, developed an alter ego, and have released some albums and done a bunch of shows and collaborations and everything else. So this research really ties into questions surrounding my own identity negotiation as a cultural producer in the world of hip-hop. And as an undergrad studying communication studies, once I began analyzing the various ways that media production can uphold certain ideologies, I really started to reflect on my role as an outside appropriator of a cultural form that emanated from a group of marginalized people that I obviously did not belong to. So at the heart of my research is this concept of authenticity. And in hip-hop, the artistic labor that takes place is centered around the performance of authenticity, as is illustrated by the lyrical performances put forth by several rap artists. So for example, the lyrics to the song Fakin' the Funk here by The Main Source, which was released in 1992, is one of a vast amount of examples of artists stressing the importance of keeping it real in hip-hop. So I turned this question of authenticity inwards and began analyzing how a guy like me could possibly attempt to be authentic in performances of rap music. But before I was able to answer that question, I had to get to the heart of what authenticity in hip-hop is all about. Many authors have discussed the importance of authenticity and have offered theories of exactly how authenticity is achieved through rap music. One author who is frequently cited is Edward Armstrong, who wrote an article about Eminem, actually, and how he attains authenticity as a white performer within a black tradition. And he says that there are three basic ways that one can attain authenticity through their rap music. The first is by being true to yourself. The second is by having local allegiances and territorial identities, with the third being having some sort of connection to an original source of rap music. And my initial reaction to this article was that it seems far too simplistic. And if I were to apply this model to an artist such as myself, it would suggest that as long as I don't put on some facade that doesn't reflect my life, as long as I represent my location in a small Ontario city, and as long as I make it clear that I have some knowledge of old school rap, I can be as real as anybody else in the world of hip hop. And I don't think that someone like me would be considered to be real from a hip-hop perspective. I think the work of Kembru McLeod, which was actually done 5 years prior to Armstrong's work, offers a far more developed and nuanced analysis of how authenticity is achieved in rap music. He provides six dimensions, the first being social-psychological, which valorizes individualism and demonizes conformity. So this is close to Armstrong's notion of being true to yourself. The second is a racial dimension, where black is seen as more real than white. The third is a gender dimension, where hard hyper-masculinity is more authentically hip-hop than soft femininity. Fourth is a social location, where the streets is more real than the suburbs. Fifth, again, is this cultural dimension, where you need to know where hip-hop came from. Sixth being this political economic dimension, where underground rap is more authentic than commercial rap. Informed by this and other subsequent research, along with my own perceptions of hip-hop culture, I prefer to reduce authenticity in hip-hop to two big umbrella categories that include these categories put forth by McLeod and Armstrong. So my first category would be having ties to urban ghetto life or the hood, whether real or proverbial. And this generally includes being black as well as hypermasculine. Second is performing a style of hip-hop that isn't tainted by commercial influences. So this idea of just being yourself and paying homage to the old school when rap was still pure. I should note that these categories are not mutually exclusive, but it does seem to be that the performance of these versions of authenticity is central to the production of rap music. Now, there are a lot of problematic elements inherent in the production of both of these versions of performing authenticity. So with this first version, there's the problematic aspect of essentializing black identity by equating it to street and ghetto life. And there's obviously a whole host of issues surrounding this. And it's also troubling when this black identity has become transformed into a commodity. And we have to question if any identity that people only really have access to through mass media outlets can ever really be considered authentic. R.A.T. Judy states that authenticity is hype, a hyper-commodified affect whose circulation has made hip-hop global. And there's been lots of scholarly work that has drawn attention to how this commodified identity came to be regarded as authentic. And it seems to be largely the result of the repetition of a cycle that has been prevalent since the days of minstrel shows, in which the white desire to gaze into the world of blackness becomes responsible for the versions of black identity that are presented through artistic performances. Depictions of black ghetto life through rap music have been extremely profitable, and this has been fueled by white fascination with difference. Many scholars, such as Trisha Rose and Bell Hooks, conclude that consuming rap music is a way for white youth to solidify their stance outside of mainstream culture. So due to this profitability, there's been a narrowing of the types of rap performers that ever get their chance in the spotlight on a large commercial scale, which has set a template for artists to follow, restricting the amount of artistic freedom possessed by performers. Rap musicians have basically been told that if they want to succeed, they have to put forth this ghetto persona, as it is the dominant style of rap that makes it onto the main stage of cultural production. So through the consolidation of performance types and the repetition of the gangsta image through popular culture, it has gained truth value. This repetition has led to its acceptance on a wide scale. The performative nature of this identity is illustrated by artists who have really exaggerated their ghetto-ness, sometimes even at the direction of white music executives. For instance, the group The Ghetto Boys were told to appear insane due to market research that suggested a demand for harsher lyrics. And Ice Cube, one of the forefathers of gangsta rap, actually came from a middle-class background and attended one of the richest high schools in Los Angeles. Patricia Hill Collins suggests that he simply possessed an awareness of what a convincing ghetto persona could buy. So to reiterate, ghetto blackness plays into white expectations of how black males are supposed to act, which is anchored to this idea of the black male as a physical, aggressive being. And it becomes extremely problematic when considering that this version of hip-hop authenticity was largely shaped by white music executives for consumption by white audiences, which subsequently feeds into the unequal relations between white and black, silencing the voices of artists who don't fit this version of authenticity. So this path to authenticity is extremely difficult for rap musicians in Canada to evoke, both black and white. Rinaldo Walcott suggests that in Canada, blackness is seen as coming from outside of the country's borders, situating an authentic black identity as a difficult thing to achieve through Canadian rap music. And with the overwhelmingly white consumption of rap, it was inevitable that eventually there would be white performers of the tradition as well. And some white performers have attempted to assert their authenticity by mimicking this version of black identity that is put forth through commercial rap. While this is difficult for any white rapper to do, it is especially difficult for white rappers living out of Canada, which I will return to shortly. But the most famous case of this type of identity appropriation can be seen in the example of Vanilla Ice, who claimed to have grown up in an impoverished, largely black area of Miami, stating that he once fell victim to gang violence. However, this was later exposed as being a fabricated life story, which entirely breaches the rules of the autobiographical nature of hip-hop. Mickey Hess, the author of Is Hip Hop Dead, suggests that Vanilla Ice made it more difficult for white rappers to attain any level of authenticity. So in the post-Vanilla Ice era, it seems that the dominant way for white rappers to acclaim authenticity within hip-hop is to claim an element of realness through their rhyming abilities. And this seems to be the approach taken not just by white rappers, but by any rapper who is considered an outsider to the dominant image of rap performance, which includes Canadians of all racial backgrounds. So this brings us into the second version of authenticity, this idea of staying true to a pre-commodified version of hip-hop before the corporations and gangsters got a hold of it. However, this nostalgic conception of rap music doesn't really exist. There are many historical accounts that display that early rappers were very concerned with receiving financial compensation for their artistic labor. And furthermore, the genre itself was arguably born out of commercial interests. The first widely known rap song to exist was The Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang, which was released in 1980. And the song was not some organic product of love-based production. It was actually a record label concoction. The group consisted of a bunch of no-name wannabe rappers who were put together by Sylvia Robinson of Sugar Hill Records with the intent to capitalize off the popularity of hip-hop block parties. Thus, the very song that catapulted the rap genre into existence wasn't some pure, untainted product, but rather it was commercially created with the intent to exploit a cultural phenomenon. When considering that rap as a genre was brought into existence due to commercial interests, the common rhetoric within hip-hop culture that opposes the idea of selling out becomes quite complicated. But it might be logical to assume that socially conscious rap that began to take prominence in the early 1980s was a more pure take on the form. However, if we trace the emergence of this conscious form of rap, it becomes clear that this was also a result of financial motivation. So this reliance on a nostalgic form of pure hip-hop that contemporary artists display to attain authenticity can be considered to be quite ineffective. The Message, a song by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, which was released in 1982, is regarded as one of the first popular rap songs that overtly dealt with the trials and tribulations of growing up black in New York. However, this song was written by an in-house musician of Sugar Hill Records, only partially influenced by the song's primary performer, Melly Mel. Which again, this breaches the rules of keeping it real. You have to write your own lyrics and rap in order to be considered authentic. So as Jeff Chang suggests, Sugar Hill's second most important rap record had been as A&R driven and as market driven as its first, the first being The Rapper's Delight. Now, I'm not attempting to neutralize the meaningful role of the socially conscious style of rap embodied by The Message. However, the conception of this style of rap as existing outside of the forces of commerce skews the historical narrative that contemporary rappers rely upon to evoke their authenticity. The Message displays how even the most assumably non-commercial versions of rap are still heavily influenced by commerce, which complicates the authentic aura that conscious rap is supposed to maintain. Thus, the two main paths that artists take to assert their authenticity are largely shaped by the interests of commerce. So after complicating the main ways to attain authenticity within hip-hop, I deduce that this ambiguous notion of authenticity that is situated as a prerequisite for any rap artist who wants to be taken seriously is probably somewhat responsible for the apparent inability for Canadian rappers to be regarded as real on a global scale. I interviewed a couple of rap performers for this paper, one of which includes the self-proclaimed Halifax rap legend Jesse Dangerously. And I asked him if he thinks a Canadian rapper can ever be regarded as real hip-hop. And he responded by saying, if it's not the 1970s, and you're not 15, and you don't live in the Bronx, then you're some measure removed from real hip-hop. And I think he's real, but I think he's right. But I think in terms of personal identity negotiation, this removal from real hip-hop is a bit exasperated for artists who work out of Canada. So as is true with virtually all forms of popular media texts, Canada is dominated by American content. As Pierre Trudeau has famously said, living next to the United States is in some ways like sleeping with an elephant. No matter how friendly and even-tempered is the beast, one is affected by every twitch and grunt. And I think this is particularly pertinent when examining Canadian hip-hop. There are barely any Canadian rap musicians who have ever attained the type of visibility that American rappers received. And to reiterate a previous point, this is likely the result of hip-hop being a black tradition and Canada being a nation that systemically excludes black people from its national identity. So one potential way to curb the effects of this would be to create a version of hip-hop rap music that aesthetically situates Canadian rap as being distinctly Canadian. Although this hasn't really occurred, and even if it did exist, it would then distance Canadian rap from this concept of authenticity due to the distinctly American origins of the genre. Furthermore, there is a serious institutional neglect of hip-hop in Canada that keeps it from the spotlight. I won't get into this in too much detail here, but overall, Canadian rap receives very minimal support from popular music outlets. One brief example lies in the Juno Awards, where similar to the Grammys, the Junos failed to televise the award for Rap Recording of the Year. This despite last year's winner being Drake, who is one of the most successful Canadian musicians across any genre in recent history. So aspiring Canadian artists are thus neglected the opportunity to witness one of their only potential role models being rewarded for their work. And this neglect further situates Canadian hip-hop as outside of the category of real hip-hop, suggesting that Canadian rap is not to be taken seriously, which contributes to the lack of cohesive identity displayed by Canadian rappers. So personally, through my rap life, I've always struggled to develop a solidified identity as a performer out of Canada. And there was another artist in Toronto who has apparently also struggled with this. Decisive is a multiple-time Juno nominee, who's one of the best-known Canadian rap musicians. And in 2010, he publicly participated in quite the identity crisis. He proclaimed that he would be ditching his previous moniker, Decisive, in favor of Derek from Northcliffe. Derek being his first name, Northcliffe being his childhood neighborhood in Toronto. Literally a week after, he was interviewed by CBC Radio 3's Vish Khanna, and he informed her that he would be changing his alias from Derek from Northcliffe to simply Derek Christoph, which is his birth name. He actually even organized a concert that was being promoted as The Funeral, where he planned to put Decisive to rest once and for all. And this was to be the last concert where he performed as Decisive, planning to release music under his legal name from this point on. However, he has since released three albums, all of which were released under his original name, Decisive. So even though attaining authenticity is arguably not possible in hip-hop at all due to the notion's compromised existence, Canadian rappers, specifically Canadian white rappers, still inhabit a position that is extremely distanced from this constructed idea of authenticity. The Canadian position as being outside of the American-specific construct of authenticity in hip-hop makes it difficult for Canadian rappers to have a solidified identity, and the complication of this process is perfectly captured by the case of Decisive's name changes. So in Jeff Harkness's 2011 analysis of white rappers in Chicago, he suggested that white rappers must actively strive to create and maintain authenticity because it cannot, per the rules of hip-hop, be granted immediately. And I do agree with this, although, again, I would suggest that this marginalized existence of Canadian rap on a global scale makes the struggle to create and maintain authenticity more difficult for white rappers who perform out of Canada, in addition to rappers from Canada in general, race aside. So with this essay thus far, I've attempted to argue that the efforts toward performing authentically within hip-hop are somewhat futile when considering that the two main processes of attaining authenticity in hip-hop are problematic and largely dictated by forces who exist outside of what one would consider to be real hip-hop. This, in conjunction with the relative invisibility of Canadian hip-hop in comparison to American hip-hop, and the institutional neglect that renders Canadian rap as less serious or worthy of attention than American rap, complicates the ability for Canadian rappers to assert their positions as authentic purveyors of rap music. Before closing, I'd like to return to one element of authenticity that was described by Armstrong, which is this notion of being true to yourself, which he suggests is enough to situate you as an authentic rap artist. Rap, arguably more so than any other art form, expects its artists to create products that are autobiographical and informed by lived experience. When I interviewed Jesse Dangerously, he stated that in his music, he's simply attempting to stay true to himself. Another artist I interviewed, Mantis from the group The Get By, said that when he writes his lyrics, he's attempting to capture exactly how he feels about a given situation at a given time. And if we revisit Decisive's identity crisis that I just described, it seems like at the heart of his name changes was the desire to present his inner identity through his music, to ditch his fake made-up name and to go back to the name he was given at birth, which connotes the idea that he wanted to abandon his rap alter ego and simply just be himself. However, art in all forms is inevitably made by people as opposed to being some natural entity, thus automatically rendering it at least somewhat artificial. Artistic selves aside, the work of Alison Hearn describes the self as being a branded entity, a self-conscious construction of a meta-image that is created through the use of cultural images and meanings drawn from mainstream culture industries. This concept of the constructed self disrupts the ability to regard autobiographical traditions, such as rap, as authentic due to the lack of natural grounding in the formation of the self that creates the cultural products. If we apply Hearn's concept of the branded self, then authentic identity must be regarded as a performance that has been constructed and agreed upon through the interaction of a number of branded selves. Thus, presentations of authenticity through expressions of the self can be regarded as a conscious performance of a particular branded self as opposed to being grounded in authentic nature. Rap is a particularly easy target for one to take aim towards when disrupting the concept of authenticity. It's supposed to be this mirror that reflects reality, but the reality that people have come to expect from rap is a racialized one with distinctly American origins, making it impossible for Canadians to be considered as valid presenters of this reality. So, in attempting to figure out how a Canadian rapper negotiates their authenticity, I ended up here, suggesting that authenticity and the creation of authenticity through rap music is far more complex and problematic than one would automatically assume. Authenticity in hip-hop music can be regarded as a social construct. It was brought into being by forces who exist outside of the narratives of keeping it real, and it is an agreed-upon notion that has gained validity through its repetition. This particular construct places Canadian musicians out of the bounds of authenticity, which is likely partly responsible for the institutional neglect of Canadian hip-hop, which has subsequently led to the issues that Canadian rappers seem to have in the process of projecting authenticity through their music, in addition to the hesitation that the global hip-hop community has towards regarding Canadian rap as real. Thank you. First, despite like all of the analyses that have like really complicated this idea of authenticity, it's still central to the discourse in rap music. Even just recently, there was a song by Waka Flocka Flame called Keep It Real, where he's talking about how real he is. It's still constantly within lyrical content. So with your second point about the indigenous rap, I've always seen it's interesting that studies of outside appropriation of hip-hop tend to situate it as a form of resistance. And I think that what's different here, what I was curious about, is that a middle-class Canadian white guy has really nothing to resist on a broader scale. So why is it that there are so many people in this position who are enamored enough by hip-hop culture to become producers of rap music? I can't remember your third question. I had something in my head when you were saying it.
Well, it's basically, you know, like there's lots of participation and contribution by Canadian artists in this larger global hip hop discussion, which is much more complex than what's happening in these kind of institutionalized American commercial hip hop, which, you know, so there's a lot more complex stuff happening. A lot of people participating. So that's why this is the question that needs to be asked, or should we be asked?
Right. Well, I think this, like, there's certainly a lot of participation, and there's certainly Canadian rap musicians who are recognized globally, although there are not very many who are able to make it into a career. Even Decisive, who's received all these Juno nominations, he works a full-time 9-to-5 job, which inhibits his ability to be able to tour and become more financially successful out of it. I know Ghetto Socks, another performer who was nominated for a Juno not last year, but the year before, despite his popularity, he can't he doesn't fund himself purely from his rap music. He does graphic design work. He does a lot of other side projects. So I think that there's still a real lack of artists who, despite being what we would consider to be professional artists, can actually make a decent living from their performances. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to jump in and say that there is a way that you can entwine those two questions around maybe around authenticity, recognition, and commercial viability, but I don't think they necessarily tie that together. I think in lots of places there is lots, there are vibrant hip-hop scenes which are not necessarily tied to commercial success. So you might want to make that argument, but I don't think it's necessary.
Okay.
I think Matt,
I guess related, you started to get to it in your month, but something circular about authenticity, right? What is authenticity measured? They measure authenticity. So I guess what I'd like you to elaborate on a little bit is what does authenticity measure? And is it really, obviously there's a lot in the discourse about authenticity. But what if you were doing your project without that concept, you couldn't use that concept, what would you be looking for?
That's a really good question. Again, I think even in all manifestations of hip hop that I see today, there still is this, it becomes trapped in this idea of being real. And in, I've been analyzing a lot of, there's these written battle raps that have really gained popularity on the internet. And a huge angle that you always see performers taking is attacking other people for not living what they rap about. But if I was to distance myself from this concept of authenticity, I still think that central to rap is just this autobiographical nature and this portrayal of your identity, which then would lead us to, again, complicating this notion of identity. And I think that's why I really liked the work of Alison Hearn treating the self as a branded entity, which, again, similar to how we complicated authenticity as being something that's constructed, we can see the very self as being something that's constructed.
It seems like there's a relationship, a difference between the branding and the expression of authenticity, right? Because authenticity, in my reading of it, is really in, it's never actually at it. It can only be a period. So one way of thinking about the relationship with Alison's work is what degree might the project of self-branding also depend on external attribution or recognition, or is it something else going on that is different than authenticity is something that has to be acknowledged and attributed. Is the brand itself dependent on that same kind of social recognition or social accolade?
I think in rap it's kind of like a little combination of both, where you're proclaiming and trying to assert yourself as being authentic with the hopes of being recognized as authentic by your audience. And authenticity becomes a real measure of, like, this idea of authenticity becomes a measure of talent and is a measure of artistic worthiness, I think. So yeah, I think there is definitely like a little push and pull between projection and projection from the person who is trying to be authentic, as well as projection of authenticity onto the performer by the audience as well.
Scott, you almost said kind of Scott.
Okay. I want to first, this fall from Susan Bowles, one quick comment that I have a question for you. Thinking that, we're talking about music and labor, the overwhelming majority of musician labor is in the non-commercial sector. And that's the one that, we're talking, a very big iceberg when you're kind of looking at the commercial, like I want to pick up on what Susan said. But my other question was similar to Matt, and as you were talking, towards the end, you started talking a bit about performance of authenticity. And I guess that makes me think of David Grayson's work on the Chicago blues scene. And he kind of argues that authenticity is not a tangible thing that can be granted or reached or grasped and paid to vote. It's a contract between audience and performer. And if I go in looking for a certain type of performance, Britney Spears is authentic. She is singing it, and that's what I expect when I go there. That's no less authentic than Bruce Springsteen getting up the acoustic guitar or going to see Woody Guthrie, who was far from authentic as a performer. I mean, it's codified as a performance, and I kind of encourage thinking about what are these different contexts, what's just taking place, and then what's that contract with those very different audiences at very different times that makes this authentic, for lack of a better word.
Right. Well, the work of, I can't remember his first name, Rodman. He wrote an article about Eminem and hip hop authenticity, and he had this really interesting discussion about artistic licenses. And he was discussing how in rap music, in particular, how again you're supposed to be autobiographical, you're supposed to only be talking about what you've actually lived. And I think where someone like Bruce Springsteen can use his position as being a like a working class American to talk about things that he didn't necessarily experience, but that other working class Americans experienced. Whereas rappers are expected to really be talking from their actual lived experience. And Rodman says this has to do with rap being a largely black form and black performers being neglected this artistic license, is what he was calling it, saying that they're perceived by the larger forces of society as lacking the creativity to come up with these fictional narratives. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
Rodman's in the book about time,
but I know there are two. I can make a very
good
point,
yeah.
Sure.
So, I just want to come back to the beginning, I'll put it after, but about how when you were 12 and about the way out of this issue with the community. And so I quote an article by Julianne Stanford, which talks about racial identity and gender and other aspects invested in the kind of vegan side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be really interesting for you to go back to in terms of thinking about how authenticity does or does not work or is performed, or you can kind of sidestep some of those questions, or avoid them, or demonstrate how authenticity is a kind of performative power game. So anyway,
okay.
I want that article to think about that.
Great, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, and all the recent work also on just dancing the culture and other content, how race has been often sidestepped in those things, and how people going back and tracking
these. Yeah, the thing I'm curious about, so you see your exposure to these are thinking about, are you looking, is that if you battle that scene?
No. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I lack the aggression necessary for a battle rap, yeah.
I think that it is a way. You're building towards work on battle rap. I think that's specifically a very, very particular sort of subset of hip hop culture where some of these debates might play out differently than in a broader macro. So I think that thinking about the really particular of the genre and the genre is important to be taken into consideration.
Thank you very much.